Welcome back to the Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guest in the studio, Jihanga Padma, who combines an academic career with her role as a Zen teacher. She has been practicing and teaching Zen for 20 years and is a PhD candidate in transpersonal psychology, doing research on traditional Buddhist healing practices. Her book, Living the Season, Zen Practice for Transformative Times, has just been released by Quest Books.
Well, I want to develop a theme that we touched on briefly earlier, and that actually arose partly because, of course, you and I got a chance to chat briefly when we were driving over here to the studio, and that's about the relationship between some of the traditional shamanistic, or not necessarily shamanistic, but often shamanistic traditions that have sort of melded in some cases with various of the lines of Buddhist tradition and practice that have arisen, and some of which would be the subject of some of the research that you're doing into healing practices. So I've been interested in this this phenomenon of shamanism itself for a long time, sensitive, of course, to the fact that shamanism as a term is actually most properly applied to certain Siberian phenomenon, but that has been a little more loosely applied as well to indigenous practices from a vast variety of traditions worldwide today. So, I know that. For example, it sounds like you've already mentioned that Korean Buddhism that you've been familiar with has an intersection with shamanic practices, and I know that Tibetan Buddhism as well, with its bon antecedents, has a similar sort of relationship. So I wonder if you could just sort of comment on this general area and the stuff that has arisen for you as you've done your research, and let's just talk.
So within the Western psychology tradition, you know, we have Carl Jung, who said that since actually consciousness and matter are continually changing places, there's really just one whole world, unus mundus. And if you see that, then you understand the connection between meditation practice and shamanism, and the connection between consciousness and healing, which is my research. Within Korean Zen, we talk about form and emptiness. So, for instance, there's this table, this wall, this book. We can touch these things. We know they're there. That's form. But all of these things return within Korean Zen, we say, to emptiness. This is the subject of the Heart Sutra, which is the kind of quintessential Mahayana Sutra. Everything returns to pure energy. Everything comes and arises from that pure energy. And within our own personal meditation practice, when we reach a point of stillness, when mind and body become one, that at that point, we directly experience and become one with this great energy. It's not just a metaphor. It's actually there. So for that reason, you know, throughout time, it's been shown that, for instance, there are Tibetan monks who are able to melt snow through their concentration practice. Heat arises, and there's a tangible physical effect. Anyone within any of the Buddhist lineages would say, of course, the purpose of this practice is not really to melt snow. There are easier ways to go about that. But through that, we can clearly see the connection. Within Korean Buddhism, actually from the very beginning, the monks who first brought Buddhism from China to Korea were healers. They demonstrated Buddhism's effectiveness by healing the daughter of the king of the Shilla dynasty. In the same way, actually within Japan, when Buddhism came from China to Japan, it was Buddhism's tangible, very pragmatic effect, you know, that they were able to bring forth a sort of greater well-being that made the emperor of Japan think perhaps there's something that's really in this. You know, we should take this up. Within Tibetan Buddhism, also the connection is very close, and within Korean Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, certainly, we have had a lot of interplay with the indigenous shamanic elements. Buddhism is by its nature very open, especially Mahayana Buddhism, right, which begins with the doctrine of skillful means, or upaya, which says that the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths 4 quadrillion different ways so everyone could receive them in the way they're best suited to. So just in that way, Buddhism took the shape of every culture, that cultural container in which it found itself. And so in Tibetan Buddhism, we see the very deep influence of its centuries-long dialogue with the Bon shamanic tradition. Sometimes one might parse it out and say, oh, this part is properly, you know, Bon practice, and this part is properly Tibetan Buddhism in the traditional way. But if you look at a practice like should practice within Tibetan Buddhism is a way of offering one's whole body to the archetypes, the deities, so to speak. And in that way, we're cleansing ourselves of the attachment to whatever unskillful conditions, whatever it is that we've been holding on to. And through that, there's a kind of revitalization that people experience both personally, and that revitalization can be used to help others. Very often a practitioner might be doing should practice to benefit a member of the community who's sick or, you know, otherwise needing healing. And so we consider that a traditional Tibetan Buddhist practice, but the interplay between that and the indigenous Bon practice is it's very deep. And actually, just a few years ago, His Holiness the Dalai Lama recognized Bon as one of the lineages of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, because there is just so much interplay.
So is there an analogous practice in the Korean tradition that can be clearly located as a strong influence from the shamanic tradition?
Within Korean Buddhism, I think the influence is in the chanting.
Mm.
Right, in the Chinese tradition, there is certainly chanting, and there is chanting to Quan Sen Bosa, you know, to Kuan Yin, right, the embodiment of compassion, you know, the compassion within us, the compassion around us, recognizing these are not separate from each other. But when Chinese monks do chanting to Kuan Yin, it doesn't have that percussion that the Korean Buddhist muktok has. It's actually much more low-key. The Korean muktok percussion is much closer to those driving rhythms that characterize shamanism across cultures.
Hmm. And in my recollection is that, and I think you even described this in your book, that it's not unusual to have extended chanting sessions, like chanting all night, like doing a Kuan Yin.
That's right.
Our friend Jim has actually hosted some of those sessions in our own meditation space, and it's a wonderful, very different kind of experience to spend hours and hours chanting.
When I lived at Mountain Spirit Center in Tehachapi, I took that opportunity to do a 90-day keto retreat. So for 3 hours, 9 to 12 every morning, I did Kwan Sambosa chanting. And it was incredible, you know, in terms of helping me to clarify my practice, to strengthen it. I don't have the luxury of being able to chant for 3 hours every morning now, but it's something that still grounds me. Mm. Also, our teacher, Songsan Sanim, he got enlightenment not doing sitting meditation, but doing a 100-day chanting retreat. You know, his autobiography is featured in a few of his books, and during that chanting retreat, he saw spirits, actually. And that is something that you don't usually find in the stories of Japanese Zen masters. It's just like that.
Hmm. Well, I want to sort of, I think it's linked, but you tell me if I'm right or wrong about this. In your book, you have a chapter devoted to the sacred feminine and about disconnection from the sacred feminine and reconnection. So I'm inferring that there is a connection to what we're just talking about, and if so, please articulate that.
Hmm. Well, within that sense of the sacred feminine, here's why I think it's so archetypally necessary for us at this time, right? The sacred feminine archetypally is something that we experience through our bodies, right? It was through a woman that we came physically into this world. Also, through that we experience the earth. You know, our through that physicality, we experience the earth. And so when we honor the divine feminine, we're honoring our bodies and we're honoring our connection to the sacred earth. One might characterize the religious paths that focus on the sacred masculine as being a little bit more focused in air, you know, having those qualities of cognition and insight. But in Buddhism, you know, in part due to those connections with indigenous practices in these cultures, we have both, you know, the Buddha, which is archetypally masculine, and in these Buddhist cultures like Tibet, Korea, China, Japan, you also have this very strong divine feminine. And if you went to a Korean temple, you would feel that devotion people have for Kwan Sambosa, you know, very tangibly. I think that it's a balance that is just needed right now at this turning point. You know, while we're looking at the condition of the earth, there are ways to turn this around, but I think that great shift begins with a change in heart.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, one question that links us back to some of the earlier discussion about the introduction of mindfulness in psychology is echoing a question that I think one of your students asked you that you responded to in the book when you had you published some of the questions and answers. And the question was, can you be a Zen practitioner and not be a Buddhist?
Absolutely.
And the reason I'm asking that question partly is that as Zen and Buddhism in general has migrated into the Western cultures, there's a adaptation that we see. But the other piece of it is that I also see Western cultures being all too willing to adapt techniques for purposes that may be different than the purpose that the tradition and the context of the tradition offers. Like, so for instance, there's much talk of mindfulness in the business community now. And it's true that spiritual integration is a benefit that may come out of that, but the benefits that are described and the motivation behind it is to make people more effective in their work, make people more effective in their careers, and more effective in their lives in general, but it's not necessarily the same foundation of radical transformation that the spiritual practices offer. So that's why I guess I'm asking, in light of the question of can you be a Zen practitioner without being a Buddhist, I'm really asking, is it possible to separate the techniques from the context? And if you agree not, then what is that context that's so essential to the practice of Zen?
So I think your question has several parts to it. I mean, it's a complex question. The first thing that I would say is that within many of the traditional Buddhist cultures, there isn't a sense that Buddhism is something that is exclusive or that requires a creed. Hmm. It's not so much a belief system as a way of practice. So in a traditional culture like China, people might have a Christian wedding, but a Buddhist funeral.
Mm-hmm.
They like the Western wedding. You know, it's beautiful. But, you know, when they're dying, it's like they want to make sure they have their ducks in a row. And then on other, for other holidays, they might do something that's a bit Taoist or Confucian. And they don't feel that there's any conflict.
Got it.
And here's the other thing that I see within your question, which is that, yes, sometimes there is cultural appropriation or oversimplification. So, for instance, there's a Buddhist center in Massachusetts that taught mindfulness to Monsanto. And I think the hope was that this was going to be liberating and transformative. I'm not sure that had the result that they had hoped. So in that way also, I'm trained as a mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher, and I honor that deeply for having open doors where there otherwise wouldn't be open doors. But then also, inevitably, when I teach that way, I say, is this really, you know, all that there is? It doesn't feel to me that it's complete. You know, knowing that as I do, that there are these healing lineages within Buddhism beyond the tools that mindfulness-based stress reduction is presenting. It's like this is coming out of a very vast history. And through my own research, it's my primary intention that I lift up some of those stories so that people can see the full spectrum. And then, you know, if mindfulness-based stress reduction is appropriate, we can use that, but not with the sense that that's all that there is.
And I guess that's the other piece of the question then, or the follow-on is, do you believe that introducing mindfulness-based stress reduction to someone who doesn't have a spiritual context may lower the barriers for someone finding that context more readily, should that be their karma?
I think that in some way we have to turn that over to the universe.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good mindfulness-based stress reduction story about a client who had been referred to mindfulness-based stress reduction because of a heart condition. Right, it was kind of like writing out a prescription. He had no spiritual interest in it particularly, and in fact had been a career military. So he was practicing mindfulness-based stress reduction completely because this was something that he had to do to check off on his, you know, his health care. But he was doing it diligently. And so one day came when he went to do his shopping at the grocery store, and he saw that the cashier in front of him was paying an inordinate amount of time, you know, to the baby that the customer in front of him was holding. You know, she was playing with it. You know, she was laughing with it. You know, he sort of felt that she should get on with it. And in fact, his type A personality was what had led him to be recommended for MBSR in the first place. So the practice of patience was something that he was working on through mindfulness. At that very time, he took a few deep breaths, gathered himself, and then had enough composure to say to the cashier, "That was a cute baby, wasn't it?" And she replied, yes, you know, in fact, that's my baby. My husband served in the Iraq war, and he died in Iraq, so I have to work full time. But my mother brings the baby in once a day so that I can see it. When he heard that, you know, of course he was very grateful that he had been able to contain himself. You know, and he sort of walked away with a deeper faith in the practice of meditation.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Well, it makes me think about a couple of the other themes in your book, Living the Season. One of which was you're talking about the idea of being able to be in disagreement with someone and yet still, as you put it, share the same table.
Mm.
I think it's a sweet. And by the way, I'll just say you were talking about healing before, and when you were saying that, I was thinking, oh, there's this parallel with Jesus, who was known as a healer,
mm.
and here. Sharing the same table is, of course, the basic idea behind the primary ritual of the Christian tradition. So I guess and one of the ways it's arisen for me when I was the year that I was doing some academic teaching of my own. I wasn't particularly interested in teaching the subject matter. I was interested in seminars to create a context where people could hold strong opinions.
Mm.
That sounds kind of Korean, the way you're describing Korean culture. And at the same time, respect each other and not have an antagonistic relationship with each other, even while holding strong opinions.
Mm.
So maybe you could talk more about this theme, because I think it's very important for our world today.
It shows up within our Korean Zen practice in the art of living in community, whether formally as monks or informally through these practice centers that Seungsan Sunim set up. So Zen Master Seungsan was very intentional about this. He described it this way. He said, in America, people will take a potato and run it under the water. One by one, it takes a long time for those potatoes to wash. In Korea, they put all the potatoes into a pot and then take a stick. And the potatoes, as they rub up against each other, make each other clean. So that potato rubbing is actually an intentional part of our Zen training. That within the Cambridge Zen Center, when I was living there, there were 45 to 50 people who had very different walks of life, very different ages, different cultures. All that we had in common actually was the practice. But through that, right, a kind of faith that this container of the practice and our intention to live together harmoniously would help us, right, with compassion and insight to find our way. But that requires a lot of letting go. You know, it's not going to be possible to have things always your own way. In fact, even if you live in a studio by yourself, you still don't always have things your own way, because inevitably, right, it's like you'll find yourself like a little bit discontent. And what is our own way, right? Would we know what that is if we saw it? So within this practice, continually releasing some of the things that we might be identifying with so as to live a little bit more flexibly. And then that flexible mind helps us to respond to each situation, right, without a trace of the last, to be completely there. Very often within our Zen communities, we did have things that we needed to resolve. It was not a paradise realm. You know, human nature is what it is. But almost inevitably, we would be able to find a place of respect and a place of connection. You know, being able to negotiate with both authenticity, being true to ourself, and sensitivity, right? Being able to see how our life is reflecting upon each other.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you. That's nicely said. And it makes me think of another phrase that really caught my attention in reading Living the Season, which was how to say no creatively.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great idea. It spoke to me immediately. But why don't you speak to that now to our listeners?
When I was living at the Zen Center as abbot, you know, living and working and practicing together with the same 45 people, a good friend taught me this practice, right? The creative no, you know, saying, being able to meet someone where they are and perhaps say, I would love to help you, right, but I cannot. You know, I would love to walk your dog for the next month, but unfortunately, I cannot. Right? I would love to attend your niece's bridal shower in Arizona, but I cannot. And in some way, through that, acknowledging the relationship and the connection, but then also having clear boundaries, because clear boundaries are also a form of compassion.
Compassion for oneself.
Right, but then also a compassion for the other. It helps the other person stay in their integrity by letting them know where your boundaries are.
Got it.
You mentioned a moment ago the term authenticity, and that figures in one of the chapters in your book about the both as a practice and as something that is cultivated. Could you speak about what your sense of authenticity is?
So my sense of authenticity is that the more that we practice, the more that we begin to touch, you know, that seed of ourself, you know, that nature which is uniquely ours to express. You know, as Martha Graham said, if you didn't live that, you know, in some way it might be lost for all time. You know, the more that we practice, the more we realize what a great gift this life is. And also, you know, life is short. So then, what are we going to do with our one wild and precious life? You know, it's up to us to really stay aligned with that, to attune to that, and to listen as that that calling might shift and change from one time to another. There was a moment when I was living in California in 2004 where I very clearly sensed and knew that it was time to go back to Boston. And then, of course, you know, after 10 years in Boston, I stayed attuned to the way that life force wanted to move through me, and kinesthetically, cognitively, emotionally, it was the right time to come here. So I've just moved to San Francisco this month.
Welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No,
no, you're about to start. Well, I was going to ask a question that's both touches on, I believe, what obligation one takes on to become a nun, but also it also speaks to the frame or the context of what constitutes practice or Zen practice in a spiritual context, as opposed to learning how to have a better free throw. And that's the five precepts.
Mm.
And you closed the book with the five precepts. I was wondering if you could describe for our audience first, what are the five precepts, and then explain how those precepts operate within the context of practice.
So the five precepts go back to the earliest time, the life of the Buddha. You know, we have already this beautiful meditation practice as a way of developing a clear heart and an open mind. But then how does that function in day-to-day life? You know, in Korean Zen, we talk about three things: substance, truth, and function. So first is attain our substance, right? Directly connect with that energy, you know, the pure awareness, right? As we do that, then everything is clear before us. You know, that everything, just as it is truth. That's beautiful. But then how does that truth function moment to moment, right? If we see someone who's hungry, give them food. If someone needs directions, show them which way to go. But, of course, life will present us with things that are a little bit more nuanced. You know, for you here in Sonoma County, it might be like driving through that fog. Things are not quite so distinct. So in those moments, when our sense of direction needs support, we have the precepts as a container. The first one being not to take life. Then the other four being not to take what is not given, not to lie or steal or abuse alcohol or sexuality. And that's just a kind of baseline, you know, to being able to live in a clear and simple way. If we're able to start out with those five precepts, then through that, we're coming into right relationship both with ourselves and others and this world.
So the precepts, I've you know, seen a lot of discussion of the precepts, and because I think a lot of Americans come to the precepts from the background of the Ten Commandments, essentially, or something like that in their lives, and so you see formulations of the precepts, you know, not framed negatively, but positively, et cetera, et cetera. And I think these are primarily intended as ameliorizations of the expectations that people bring to those. And what you've just said is very, you know, clear and straightforward. I wonder what you would say, though, to people who come to the precepts from the kind of place where...
I'm like, thou shalt not.
Thou shalt not. Right.
So, especially, here's what we would say about Zen precepts. Sometimes in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, people might take precepts literally. So, literally, not to touch alcohol, right? Literally... if you're a monk, not to handle money, not to eat afternoon, etc. Mm-hmm. In Mahayana precepts, we look at the spirit of the precepts rather than the letter. And in Zen, actually, it's even more broad, even more wide. We say any action is not good or bad, but ultimately, why do you do what you do? So traditionally, we tell a story, for instance, about this great monk in Korean, actually Chinese tradition, Zen master Nam Chan. The first precept is not to take life. But within this particular temple, you know, the monks of the Eastern and Western halls had gotten really attached to this cat. It wasn't, you know, they just didn't have anything else to do because monastic life is so simple. So they a little bit lost their direction and they ended up fighting each other over this cat. So then Zen Master Namchan took the razor, which he uses to shave his head, right? The razor, which is a symbol of the precepts, he took it to the cat's neck and said, if you can say one word, I'll save this cat. But if you can't, I'll kill it. So at that time, he broke the first precept, the most primary precept. But the reason he broke the precept, you know, it was to help to awaken his students, to shake them out of that that dream of self-centeredness. And for that reason, actually, that was very high-class teaching. To this very day, students who come into a Zen center are presented with that koan as a teaching tool. You know, Zen Master Namchan says, give me one word, so then what will you do? And because many of us enter the Zen Center with a question about what is love really, that shakes us. You know, it sticks with us day and night. And we work it. I remember when I was working on that koan, and it had driven me practically to tears. And, you know, Sung San saw that, and he actually gave me a hug then. And that was one of these moments of real connection, you know, a sense of coming home. Because that question of what is love is one of those primary human questions. And that koan presented us with a way in to look at it.
Wow. Thank you. This is very interesting to me because I don't think I've ever... We've had a number of Zen practitioners that we've spoken with over the years. I don't think any of them has ever mentioned the question, what is love, as being a primary... Not that they haven't spoken at times about the question, but you said something like one of the main questions that people bring when they come to a Zen center is, what is love? And I think that's a really interesting point to make. So it sounds like that was certainly true for you.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm hearing you say as well that it wasn't just you, but that you saw that question present for others as well. Is that true?
Absolutely, beyond a doubt. I see it in so many ways, you know, both with college students that are struggling over their first deep relationships, with the parents that I counsel, you know, that are struggling to raise their children in a conscious way and not sure as the children grow up what exactly is that true way.
Right, right. I'm reminded we have talks at our store. In fact, you're going to be giving one, as Stuart will announce shortly, this coming Thursday at Many Rivers in Sebastopol. And on this last Thursday evening, as the talk let out, there were two young men on the sidewalk out in front of the store, and one of them was crying. And I asked, you know, I stopped and when I saw that and asked if they were okay, and the other one indicated that this young man had just, you know, essentially had his girlfriend had told him that they weren't girlfriend and boyfriend anymore, and so it was obviously a very powerful moment for him. And this other man seemed to be giving him emotional support in a way that was touching for me to see. And you just now mentioned that Sung San, your Zen master, as well, gave you support at a moment when that was important. And I think this is such a wonderful point. We're getting close to the end here, and this is a great place to sort of wind towards our conclusion, because I don't think people think of Zen in that way so much. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that as the context in which Westerners see Zen practice. But if you do, I'd love to hear it.
I would say that both within Korean Zen and within Japanese Zen, you know, there are teachers, you know, who are teaching from that place, you know, the place of an open heart. And within the practice, I think through mindfulness, one develops a greater intimacy with oneself. And then also there's an intimacy at the heart of Zen training. The connection between teacher and student, that the lineage has always been passed from warm hand to warm hand, so to speak. That connection to a teacher, that intimacy, takes very different forms. But I've been fortunate to have teachers who supported me in working with that basic human connection. And I think that quality of energy is so deeply needed right now, that in addition to formal Zen training, I include metta, loving-kindness practice.
Yeah.
Because we just really need to awaken the heart in a clear and compassionate way.
Thank you. There's Just one point, because not everyone may know what metta is, even though it's explained nicely in your book, maybe you should just briefly mention that.
Metta is love without conditions. And so when we practice metta, we begin with ourselves. As one of my teachers would say, charity begins at home, and then that becomes the foundation through which we can cultivate loving kindness for our friends, for people who we don't have a strong feeling for, and ultimately for all beings, because all beings are part of our family.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This is we'd like to let you take a couple of minutes right now just to let our audience know what the work you're doing, how they might be able to get in touch with you if they want to follow up, and if there's websites or of the like.
I offer consulting through spiritual counseling, through astrology consultations, and through formal teaching. My work can be found on the website www.natural-wisdom.org and through the blog www.naturalwisdom.blogspot. And I'm going to be doing some workshops at Omega Institute over the summer. Right now, I'm practicing locally in the Bay Area, but I'm happy to connect with people in wherever they might live. You know, we can arrange a sort of Skype or phone session. My work on Buddhism and healing is due out in June.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, we really appreciate the time you took this afternoon. It was a wonderful conversation.
My honor and pleasure, truly.
I'm glad, and so we wish you well in future, and perhaps we can hear more about your work with Buddhist and non-Buddhist healing techniques in future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I have been speaking this week with our guest in the studio, Jihang Padma, who combines an academic career with her role as a Zen teacher. She has been practicing and teaching Zen for 20 years and is a PhD candidate in transpersonal psychology, doing research on traditional Buddhist healing practices. Her book, Living the Season, Zen Practices for Transformative Times, has just been released by Quest Books. Next week, The Mystical Positivist will feature an interview in the studio with John Suslov. John Suslov is a student of the great wisdom traditions. From an early age, John has had the conviction that there is more to our inheritance of myth, tradition, and religion than meets the eye. He graduated from a Russian Orthodox seminary, but after having been exposed to the work of Henry Corbin, he became an ardent student of many of the great traditions, including the Greek Platonic tradition, Eastern Christianity, Islam, and the Chinese and Indian traditions. He is an advocate for the position that the myths and religious traditions speak a language and refer to a vision of reality that differs significantly from everyday language and the reality to which everyday language refers. Tune in for that show on Saturday, February 22nd, 2014. Upcoming on the spiritual calendar in Sonoma County, the Renewal of Presence Practice Group with the Tayu Meditation Center staff will be meeting Tuesday at 7:30 p.m., February 18th, at Mini Rivers Books and Tea at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. And then on Thursday, as part of the Thursdays at Mini Rivers series, Living the Season, Zen Practice for Transformative Times. Our guest today, Jihang Padma, author of Living the Season, will be giving a talk in Sebastopol. That's Thursday, February 20th at 7:30 p.m. As most of us cannot deny, we are in the midst of complete transformation, ecologically, economically, politically, and culturally. Living the Seasons gracefully introduces creative safe passage through the sometimes overwhelming transition, drawing on ancient and contemporary spiritual practices to create an essential hands-on guide, a beginner's guide to developing a meaningful meditation practice for daily life. Author and spiritual teacher Jihang Padma organizes teachings around the four seasons. By connecting to these natural rhythms, the harvest of autumn, stillness of winter, renewal of spring, and the ripening of summer, we touch a wholeness that is the source of healing and happiness. This evening combines Zen practice with creative approaches that support this attunement of mind-body with the world around us. We will use sacred ceremony and metta-meditation to harness the power of group consciousness for the purposes of personal and societal transformation. And then on Saturday, March 1st, Losar, the Tibetan New Year celebration, and art auction and fundraiser for the Tibetan Gallery and Studio in the Barlow, that's 6770 McKinley Street in Sebastopol. That's Saturday, March 1st from 4 to 7 p.m. In honor of Losar, the Tibetan New Year, the Tibetan Gallery and Studio and the Dalai Lama Foundation present a special celebration featuring an art auction and fundraising event. The auction will include a Tibetan tonka and works by Tashi Dargyal, founder of the Tibetan Gallery and Studio, as well as selected works from the Dalai Lama Foundation's art exhibition, The Missing Piece, Artists Consider the Dalai Lama. All the proceeds from the evening will be shared equally between the two organizations. The event will open with a special blessing by local Tibetan monks, and there will be a silent auction as well as a live auction featuring art as well as experiential items. Catered hors d'oeuvres with wines by Marmart Estate, Bevan Cellars, McPhail, La Follette, Heston Vineyards, and non-alcoholic beverages provided by the Kieferi. We'll also be sampling some traditional Losar foods. In addition to the auctions, there'll be live entertainment featuring Tibetan musicians. Tickets are available for $108 and from Brown Paper Tickets, or you can go to tibetangallery.brownpapertickets.com.
And I'm just going to jump in here and mention that 2 weeks after that March 1st event, on March 15th at the Tibetan Gallery, there's going to be a fundraiser for the Festival of Conscious Parenting. I will have more information about that on next week's show. But you can go to the website www.tfocp.org or festivalofconsciousparenting.org. To find out more about that in the future. So look forward to hearing more about that on this show.
Great. Cows Community Radio thanks the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center for their support. OAEC is a nonprofit education center in Sonoma County that works to promote ecologically and culturally sustainable communities. OAEC is involved in local watershed restoration, school garden development, and features Garden Volunteer Day every Wednesday from 10 to 5. Keep up with current events by visiting their website, www.oaec.org, or call them at 707-874-1557. Cal's Radio welcomes Sonoma Smiles, the office of Dr. Wayne Sutton, DDS, and thanks him for supporting community radio. Sonoma Smiles offers sedation dentistry for all your needs in one location. They also specialize in both cosmetic and implant dentistry. Sonoma Smiles also provides safe mercury filling removal. Sonoma Smiles is located in Roanoke Park at 1330 Medical Center Drive, Suite 1. They can be reached by telephone at 707-585-2555 or on the web at sonomasmiles.com. Just a final reminder, Cal's Community Radio is having a benefit. This will be at Sally Tomatoes on Friday, February 28th. It's 1100 Valley House Drive in Roanoke Park. The benefit is a $20 ask with a buffet, drink tickets, and live music. The proceeds will be benefiting Cal's Radio. Doors open at 7 p.m. Music starts at 8 p.m. The Rotten Tomatoes and Wilson Huckel Blues Review will be performing. Sounds like a great party, and it's a great way to have fun and support cows at the same time. So for more information, go to www.sallytomatoes.com or call 707-665-9472. Thank you for joining us once again for the Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. And please send comments and feedback to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Join us again next Saturday. Coming up from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rock and Record Hop, so stay tuned. Until then, we'll be listening to a piece called Carillon by Paul Charles Durant from the CD The Lute in Dance and Dream, performed by lutenist Lutz Kirchhoff. Enjoy!